Okay, good morning, everybody. It's Bio 241, and it is March 20th. We're going to get into autonomic nervous system today, which is Chapter 9. But I know I promised you all that we're going to look at this neuron drawing. This is an exam figure, and it has a lot of information on it. Probably everything that you learned in this chapter we could describe just with this illustration right here. All right, so what do we see? Well, we see a neuron, just a nice multipolar neuron. See a bunch of dendrites, a nice long axon terminus. And I see a bunch of little clouds around the axon terminus. What is that supposed to represent? See these little dots right here, these little clouds? Let's see if I can make it a little bit bigger. Oh, that's good. Yeah, this little cloud right here, that is? Yeah, a neurotransmitter. And can you give me a name of a neurotransmitter? Like acetylcholine would be a really good example, right? And, okay, the axon I see has some support cells around them. Can you remember the name of those support cells? They're Schwann cells. And so where is this axon located? Peripheral nervous system. And the Schwann cell makes a certain kind of sheath around this axon. And what do we call that? Myelin sheath acts as insulation, but the sheath is not continuous. It has breaks in the sheath. What do we call these breaks? Oh, it's not on this illustration. Nodes of Grandier. That's right. So an action potential, remember, hops from one node to the next to the next. And is that relatively fast or slow? It's fast, right? Myelinated axons are fast. What kind of conduction do we call that when it skips? Saltatory conduction is fast, as opposed to what kind of conduction? Continuous, and that is slow, and that's when you have a non-myelinated axon. Okay, so a nerve impulse is something in motion. There's a change in membrane voltage or membrane potential. What do we call that thing that is a change in membrane voltage that skips down, that produces that nerve impulse? What is that thing that skips down from node to node to node? It is an action potential. Yeah, so a nerve impulse is an action potential in motion, moving someplace. Okay? And action potential, because it's not a constant voltage. It's a voltage that increases or depolarizes and then repolarizes. All right, so an axon, in order to have an action potential, what does the cell membrane have to have in order to produce an action potential? And support an action potential? It's got to have voltage-gated channels, right? So axons have voltage-gated channels. And, of course, those are just channels that open and close depending on what the voltage is across the membrane. All right, so let's maybe think of some more about action potentials. How would you compare action potentials? Do they have different heights? Do they have different durations? No, they are what? They're exactly the same. And what about an action potential near the axon hillock compared to the axon terminus? It's exactly the same. Same duration, same magnitude. All right, so an action potential moves down an axon in a certain way. And how do we, what do we call that certain way? It moves. How does an action potential move? Since it never dies away, it moves without decrement. Yeah, that's what you want to be thinking of, without decrement. Okay, but before an action potential starts, something has to happen. What has to happen first? Before there's an action potential, even if there's voltage-gated channels right here, what has to happen first? And it's particular to an action potential. The membrane potential or voltage has to reach a threshold. So an action potential does have a threshold. Okay, so that's important for you to know. So action potential needs voltage-gated channels. It has to receive a threshold stimulus. And an action potential travels without decrement. Now, can we add action potentials together? Do action potentials summate? They do not. Okay? All right, and so that's what happens on an axon. Now, can an action potential go from the axon terminus back up to the cell body? No, it can't, because an action potential has refractory period. That's something else special about an action potential. All right. And the first place where you run into these voltage-gated channels is in the part of the axon hillock that we call the trigger zone. The cell body and dendrites don't have voltage-gated channels, but there are gated channels What kind of gated channels do we find in dendrites and cell bodies? Ligand gated channels, which means then that in order for them to operate open or closed, they have to bind a small signaling compound that generally we might call them a ligand binding to a receptor, okay? And that can open and close channels. So because there are ligand gated channels in dendrites in the cell body, what part of the neuron is that? As opposed to the axon. Okay, the axon is doing what to a signal? It's sending, yeah, so the axon is the sending part, but dendrites and cell body are the receiving part, right? So they're, in a sense, sort of listening to those signaling molecules before they bind to the receptor, right? So these dendrites and cell body can respond to that signaling compound if they have the proper receptor for it. Okay? And then that will start, will that start an action potential on a dendrite and cell body? Because the dendrite and cell body is missing voltage-gated channels. It only has ligand-gated channels. And when those ligand-gated channels open and or close, that doesn't cause an action potential. It does cause some kind of potential. How could we talk about what kind of potential that was? Okay, it's a graded potential. Yeah, graded potential. Sometimes your book calls that a synaptic potential. And a graded potential just means that the, what about the magnitude or amplitude? Can it change? Yes, it changes, unlike an action potential. What about the duration? The duration can change as well. And as a graded potential moves from the tip of a dendrite over the cell bodies, what happens to it? It dies away, right? So it travels with decrement as opposed to an action potential. And does a graded potential have a threshold? Nope, it's just a thing all by itself, right? It changes membrane potential, doesn't need a threshold to be met. So it can be a really tiny graded potential, or it could be a very large graded potential, depending on how many of those ligand-gated channels are bound with their particular ligand. Okay, so then you know that the, what's another name for a body of a neuron? Here's the soma right here. So you should know what kind of gated channels are on the soma. What else about here? Try to think of these dendrites as maybe antennas. So dendrites and cell body are what part of the neuron? The receiving part, right? So they receive chemical signals from neighboring neurons. Here's a junction between an axon terminus of one neuron and the cell body of another neuron, a different neuron. And information is going to go across this junction right here. And the thing that moves across this junction is a chemical, right? And so what do we want to call this junction? Yeah, it's a synapse, right? That's the structural and functional unit of communication between cells. And since it's a signaling molecule or chemical that goes from one cell to another, then we call this a chemical synapse. It's not an electrical. Chemical synapses are mostly how cells communicate with each other. There's very few electrical kinds of synapses. All right, so make sure you understand that the receiving part of a neuron is the receiving part because it has ligand-gated channels. The sending part of a neuron, right, can send information because it has voltage-gated channels, and be able to compare and contrast the difference between a graded potential and an action potential. Couple other things that I noticed right here. I see something called an EPSP and an IPSP. And these are, here are some subclassifications of a general class of a ligand-gated channel. I see nicotinic and I see muscarinic. Right, so these are going to bind one particular neurotransmitter. Do you know what kind of neurotransmitter binds to a nicotinic and a muscarinic? Acetylcholine. So these are what we call cholinergic receptors, right? Because these presynaptic neurons, like where I have the cursor right now, release acetylcholine. And then the postsynaptic neuron has to have acetylcholine receptors in order for information to move across. All right. And A typical nicotinic receptor is just a simple ligand-gated channel. When acetylcholine or when two acetylcholines binds to that receptor, then the channel opens up and sodium floods into the cell. And how does that change membrane voltage when sodium enters from the outside? It becomes less negative, and we call that depolarization. And is that excitatory or inhibitory? Then it's going to be excitatory because that raises the membrane potential up toward threshold by the time that graded potential reaches this trigger zone right here. So if it causes depolarization, we call that an EPSP. And nicotinic type cholinergic receptors are always going to be excitatory, right? There are no inhibitory cholinergic nicotinic receptors. On the other hand, there's another class that we call muscarinic. And on this diagram right here, we see that it can produce an IPSP, right, which is going to cause hyperpolarization. But what's kind of missing on this slide is that a muscarinic receptor could either be excitatory or inhibitory. All right, so you might want to jot that down on this particular slide. An EPSP, 100% excitatory. Right, I mean a nicotinic 100% excitatory, but a muscarinic receptor sometimes can inhibit and sometimes it can excite depending on how this receptor is working. And a muscarinic receptor is always going to be a G protein coupled receptor. So G proteins are going to be activated, and then depending on what kind of protein those G proteins run into, they can either open or close that channel, causing hyperpolarization or depolarization. All right. There's a class of receptors that I don't see on this slide, and that would be adrenergic receptors. I don't think we talked about adrenergic receptors, but what would be the ligand? Anybody have a guess what would be a ligand for an adrenergic receptor? It wouldn't be sensitive to acetylcholine, but it would be sensitive to something we call adrenaline, and another name for adrenaline is epinephrine, right? And noradrenaline, sometimes we don't really talk about it like that, is norepinephrine. Those are adrenergic compounds, right? So they have to have adrenergic receptors. Right? And those could either be excitatory or inhibitory because they work through G protein coupled receptors like the muscarinic receptor here. All right, so a muscarinic receptor is what, a ligand gated channel or a voltage gated channel? Ligand gated channel. And it has to bind acetylcholine to become activated. Okay, so what am I missing on this slide? What else did you find really helpful about this slide? That's a lot of information on here. Okay, any questions at all? Not so far. Okay, well, I think we're pretty much done with this chapter. And if we look at the schedule, all right, so today is the 20th. And we're going to start talking about autonomic nervous system. And then on next Tuesday, the 25th, that is your second exam. And everybody knows that's on what? 4, 5, and 7, right? Chapters 4, 5, and 7. Study guide is important. End of chapter questions in the study guide. Online questions in the study guide. Exam figures. This is an exam figure that I'm showing you here. Yeah. It is. It is part of the study guide. Yeah, it's in the study guide for chapter 7. And I actually have two figures. I have this one that's labeled, and then I have one and I erased all the labels so you could practice labeling it. And the key is there as well. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, let me say something about this a little bit more. Okay, so we see nicotinic receptors and muscarinic receptors. They are similar because the ligand that binds to those receptors is acetylcholine. Will bind to both and activate those gated channels. They have different names because some compounds have a shape that's similar to acetylcholine, and one of those molecules is nicotine. And nicotine can bind to these ligand-gated channels that produce EPSPs, and it can activate them. Nicotine, on the other hand, can't bind to the receptor of the muscarinic type. The shape just is not exact enough to do that. These muscarinic types can bind acetylcholine, but not nicotine. All right, so that's why these over here we call nicotinic type cholinergic receptors, because they bind nicotine as well as acetylcholine. The muscarinic receptors bind acetylcholine, but another compound that we call muscarin that comes from poisonous mushrooms. All right, so that's why we named this class muscarinic. All right, that muscarin can't bind to the nicotinic type receptor because it doesn't have the right shape. It has partially the right shape, but not enough to be an agonist on that particular receptor. So there are some subclasses of cholinergic receptors, like nicotinic and muscarinic. And there's even some subclasses of muscarinic receptors, and I'm not going to get into that in this class, but you'll probably see that in some discussions in the chapter. You should probably be aware of that. But we're going to be interested in pretty much all the different kinds of classes of adrenergic receptors, right? And the agonist for those receptors, or the ligand that binds to those receptors, will be norepinephrine. And those are what we call adrenergic receptors, not cholinergic. We're going to get into that in autonomic nervous system. Okay. So nicotinic, muscarinic, subclasses of cholinergic receptors. Nicotine binds to nicotinic types. Muscarin binds to muscarinic types. So there's enough of a difference between nicotine and muscarin to where they don't cross-react on different kinds of receptors, even though they're both cholinergic. Yeah. Okay. And a nicotinic type is always excitatory, but a muscarinic could either be excitatory or inhibitory, depending on what channels are open. And so that's what we got to start talking about right now. Okay. Any other questions on this diagram? You like this diagram? Yeah, I heard one, yes. Okay. Okay, super. All right, so I'm just going to minimize this. Where did I have that? Neuron drawing. Okay, I loaded it as a JPEG, but it is also in Chapter 7. Chapter 7 study guide. Oops, where is that at? Do you have a button for study guides here? Yeah, study guide someplace. Ah, right here, in Chapter 7. It's in there. The key and the one with the labels erased from it. But you should use it like a concept map, right? Talk about everything you know about the nervous system on that one diagram right there. We could even talk about the different kinds of synapses. Ooh. Do I see different kinds of synapses here? Oh, they all look like what kind? They come from an axon and they end up on the cell body, so these are axosomatic. But there could be some on dendrites. We would call those axodendritic, but just not included on this particular diagram. Okay. And either one could be nicotinic or muscarinic. All right. So let's get to the topic that we want to talk about today, which is autonomic nervous system. And you guys are well prepared for autonomic nervous system because you all have had anatomy. So a lot of this chapter is review, and if it doesn't seem like a review for you, then guess what you have to do? You have to review. Okay, you got to become familiar with the anatomy of the autonomic nervous system. I'll talk about it fairly quickly, and it will probably come back to you. All right, so any questions on the schedule? Next time is exam 2. And what do you need for exam 2? You need a scantron that isn't crinkled or mutilated, a clean one, right? No spindled scantrons. What else? Eraser. What kind of eraser? One that works with your pencil, which is also what you have to bring, right? All right, so don't bring a really good eraser that erases a pencil that you don't have with you. That won't help. And what else do you need? You need a photo ID. I don't think you need a calculator for this particular test. You could bring it, but I can't remember that you need a calculator for this exam. All right, so picture ID, pencil, eraser, scantron. Okay, and that's it. No hats, hood, sunglasses. Before the exam, make sure you go to the bathroom, not during the middle of the exam. All right, so let's get into Chapter 9, autonomic nervous system. The autonomic nervous system manages our body, controls a whole bunch of organs and organ systems without our conscious control, right? So it's like an automatic control system. It controls a number of effector organs, and so let's compare that with another kind of nervous system, and that is the somatic nervous system. What kind of effector organ does the somatic nervous system control? It's under voluntary control, somatic nervous system, and it is only skeletal muscle. And of all of the things in your body, all the millions of things in your body, the only thing that you can control with your conscious thought is skeletal muscle. That's the only thing. Everything else is controlled by the autonomic nervous system. All right, and there are three general classes of effectors in the autonomic nervous system. I think that you should have on the tip of your tongue. They are, how about skeletal muscle? And the answer is no, not skeletal muscle, because that's somatic. So the effector organs are cardiac muscle, smooth muscle, and glands. Right, those are the effector organs. And when they operate, what do those effector organs produce? What do they produce in our body? And you have to think of a response loop, right? So those effector organs produce a response. Yeah, that's the job of an effector organ, and we see them here, smooth muscles, glands, and unfortunately left off this slide is cardiac muscle. All right, so we're kind of aware, we're familiar with the somatic nervous system because we use it constantly all day long, and we know that when a nerve impulse or an action potential reaches that neuromuscular junction, it causes contraction of a skeletal muscle, right? And under normal physiology, that skeletal muscle can't contract unless it's getting a signal from the brain, and when it gets a signal from the brain, it can't make up its mind not to contract or contract partially. It either contracts or doesn't, contracts with 100% of its ability to do that, and it always listens to that signal from the brain, can't make any decision on what to do. Okay, smooth muscle, on the other hand, and cardiac muscle to a large degree, don't use that same kind of mechanism. Right? Smooth muscle can contract on its own. Smooth muscle all by itself produces a resting tone or a slight bit of contraction even in the absence of nerve stimulation, which is a lot different than skeletal muscle. Right? So it has the ability to contract all on its own. And as a matter of fact, when a nerve is taken away from a smooth muscle, right, it doesn't become flaccid. It actually is, it goes into a more sensitive state where it goes into a higher tone. Right? So the resting tone increases and there's more spasm in smooth muscle. Right? If you denervate a skeletal muscle, it can't contract. If you denervate a smooth muscle, the contraction, right, gets actually stronger. We call that denervation hypersensitivity. So that's what happens when people lose innervation to smooth muscle. Right? Those muscles become more irritable and they contract more on their own. Totally different than for skeletal muscle. All right, many kinds of smooth muscle not only produce a resting tone, a slight contraction, some are spontaneously active and will contract maximally and rhythmically without any kind of autonomic nervous system input. And remember, skeletal muscles can't do that. And the autonomic nervous system is just there to adjust the rate of that contraction and the length of those contractions. So smooth muscle, right, can't contract all by itself, and the nerves that go there just adjust the properties of that contraction. And when those nerves are taken away, then those muscles contract even more strongly. Different than a somatic. All right, so we're going to compare a somatic outflow pathway and an autonomic outflow pathway, which you're familiar with already. Let's start with a somatic motor pathway. I see a nice spinal cord, I see some gray matter, white matter, cell body of the motor neuron is in the gray matter, right? And that's going to be what the ventral horn of the gray matter, and then it's going to leave the spinal cord. How does this motor signal leave the spinal cord? I see a root. What kind of root is this? Okay. Basal root ganglia, I do find in the brain. And maybe we'll get to talk about that, but this is a spinal root, and this is the ventral root, right? So all signals leave the central nervous system, which means what? It's a motor signal through the ventral root. It's 100% motor. All right, so action potentials leave the central nervous system into this motor neuron. This is what we call a somatic motor neuron. And how many neurons does it take to get from the central nervous system to this effector organ? How many do you see? There's just one, right? So there's no synapses. I see the cell body here. Now let's trace it around. Axon, 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 terminus. One cell, all the way down. Okay, and since this is a somatic motor system, what is the effector organ? Yes, a skeletal muscle, and that's going to move your skeleton around. Okay, well, let's think a little bit more in terms of a response loop. Sometimes this muscle contracts due to some irritation on the surface of your body. So here is some receptors, and that stimulates an action potential in this neuron, which brings it into the central nervous system. So what kind of pathway is this? It's not a motor pathway. It is a sensory pathway. And what's another name for a sensory pathway? That's afferent, right? Another name for motor is efferent. Yeah, so I see an efferent, afferent pathway. And this is not a multipolar neuron. What kind of neuron is this for an afferent pathway? That's that pseudo-unipolar. You can see the cell body right here in this bulge. And so this is the peripheral process. Here's the central process of that sensory neuron. And so there's a group of thousands of nerve cell bodies, because there's thousands of sensory nerves entering this root right here. What do we call a group of nerve cell bodies in the peripheral nervous system? Peripheral nervous system. That's a ganglion, right? Is gray matter in the peripheral nervous system is a ganglion. What do we call nerve cell bodies, a group of nerve cell bodies in the central nervous system? Somebody mentioned that. That is a nucleus, right? So nucleus and ganglion are pretty much the same thing, except one's in the peripheral nervous system, one's in the central nervous system. All right, so hopefully you can appreciate that nice structure of that pseudo-unipolar neuron. And that central process enters the spinal cord via what route? The dorsal root, right? The dorsal root is 100% sensory. There's no motor component to it at all. All right, so this top slide right here, I see that for a somatic outflow pathway from CNS to effector organ, there is just one neuron. And here's a neuromuscular junction where this nerve, this motor nerve, is going to control the skeletal muscle. We have neuromuscular junctions, and the neurotransmitter is going to be acetylcholine. Okay, 100% of the time. And you have a choice of receptors. You could use a nicotinic or a muscarinic receptor right here. And so I'll just tell you, it's always 100% a nicotinic receptor. Right? There are no muscarinic receptors in skeletal muscle. The other interesting thing about this skeletal muscle is the following. Okay. Where did you find voltage-gated channels on a neuron? Yeah, pretty much only an axon only. And they first appear in that axon hillock region. Sometimes we call that a trigger zone. Nerve cell bodies and dendrites don't have voltage-gated channels. They do have ligand-gated channels, so they can produce graded potentials. Now, here's something strange about that neuromuscular junction. It does have ligand-gated channels of that nicotinic type, so that graded potentials can be initiated on the cell membrane of these skeletal muscles, but right within that neuromuscular junction, or right on the periphery of it, there are also voltage-gated channels. So if there's any kind of graded potential in that neuromuscular junction, it always triggers an action potential. All right. So that skeletal muscle can never make up its own mind whether it's going to contract. If there's an action potential coming down this axon, the skeletal muscle is going to contract, because it always produces an action potential, because ligand-gated channels and voltage-gated channels are kind of mixed together right within the neuromuscular junction. Okay, let's go down to the second slide. I see a sensory nerve fiber, nice pseudo-unipolar neuron coming in the dorsal root, or dorsal root ganglia. Right, but now this is going to be an autonomic outflow pathway. So the autonomic motor leaves through the ventral root, just like the somatic does, and it joins the spinal nerve. Remember, spinal nerve is a combination of both roots. So this is both sensory and motor. We call that mixed. That motor neuron then enters that spinal nerve. And it's going to go into something that looks like another little tiny spinal cord. On either side of the vertebral column, there are a bunch of, what do we call these nodes in the peripheral nervous system? Kind of looks like this one right here. That's a ganglion, right? So they're nerve cell bodies in each one of these nodes, and they're connected together. Axons do connect these things together. And so these things are only for the sympathetic nervous system, and sometimes we call these the sympathetic chain ganglia. And there's going to be one on the right side of the vertebral column, one on the left, on either side, and it's purely for sympathetic activity, for sympathetic tone. So these are almost acting like spinal cords for sympathetic activity, but they're much smaller. All right, so how does that involve this motor neuron coming out of the central nervous system? Well, it gets into the spinal nerve, and it enters the sympathetic chain, okay, via a special little route right here that we call a communicantes. And it can enter, and I see that's the end of this neuron. And then here is the cell body of a second neuron, and then it leaves that ganglion, goes into another nerve, and it goes all the way to smooth muscle, and this looks like maybe some digestive tract or something, right, which is a visceral organ. All right, so if we compare with somatic, how many neurons does it take to get from CNS to the effector organ, in this case, smooth muscle? It's two, right? For somatic, is just one. Okay, this synapse right here in the sympathetic chain is going to be a nicotinic-type receptor as well, right? So since this is in a ganglion, this first neuron we call the preganglionic cell. The distal one is what we call the postganglionic cell. So instead of presynaptic, postsynaptic, we say preganglionic and postganglionic. The neurotransmitter is going to be acetylcholine, and the kind of receptor is going to be a nicotinic type, which is just a nice, simple ligand-gated channel, not a G-protein-coupled channel. All right, so this is what we call an autonomic ganglion. So almost 100% of all autonomic outflow pathways require two neurons to exert their effect on effector organs for the autonomic nervous system, which you know to be smooth muscle, cardiac muscle, and glands. All right, this is just the same figure once again. Okay, that was just a general comparison. Divisions of the autonomic nervous system. All right, what's the best way to control something? Like the best way to control your car. What's the best way? You have to have a gas pedal and a brake pedal, right? Antagonistic control gives you precise control and balance. Well, the autonomic nervous system, since it's controlling very important organs in our body, there are two divisions. Right, they're sympathetic and parasympathetic, and so you could probably guess what the relationship is between these two different divisions. They're going to be antagonistic to each other. So that's not a futile thing, that's a very good thing, right, for precise control and balance. If you want to think of each of those divisions, this is a really good way to think of them. The sympathetic mediates the fight, flight, or stress reaction in our body. Right, so that kind of tells us a lot. So if you're hyper excited about something, what happens to your heart rate? It increases, right? What happens to your respiratory rate? It increases as well. Okay, and your pupil diameter due to the iris will dilate so that more light can enter your eye so that you have better perception of what's happening around you. And for instance, if you're flying away or running away from a stressful circumstance or a threatening circumstance, you need to have a lot of blood going to your digestive tract to digest things that you've just eaten. Compared to, should you have blood flow going to skeletal muscle that you're using to fly away, if you had a choice? Yeah, skeletal muscle, right? So the sympathetic nervous system inhibits the digestive tract so that skeletal muscles can operate efficiently. Parasympathetic, on the other hand, is what we call the rest and digest nervous system. And so that is excitatory on the digestive tract, and that causes pupil constriction, and it causes reduced heart rate, it causes reduced respiration, pretty much the opposite effect compared to the sympathetic. All right, so a really good way to understand sympathetic and parasympathetic is that they produce antagonistic or opposite effects in the body. Not 100% of the time, but most of the time. And you can't tell, you can't say that sympathetic is always excitatory or parasympathetic is always inhibitory. You can only say that sympathetic and parasympathetic are what? Opposite each other. And so you have to just kind of figure out when is the sympathetic excitatory and when is sympathetic inhibitory. And these two designations here, fight, flight, and stress versus rest and digest, is a really nice key to help you understand what might be happening in your body, because you're aware of what happens to you, right, when you're scared. Heart rate goes up, respiratory rate goes up. Okay. So let's talk about the sympathetic division first. Remember, how does sympathetic activity leave our central nervous system? And it's not through cranial nerves. It's not through spinal nerves in the cervical region. It's only in the thoracic region and parts of the lumbar region, from T1 down to L2. So sometimes we call the sympathetic division the thoracolumbar division, because that's how sympathetic activity leaves our central nervous system. It's only through those levels. Right, so it leaves through the ventral root, okay, and then it goes through a ramus communicantes into the sympathetic chain, and there's going to maybe synapse with the postganglionic fiber, and then that postganglionic fiber is going to rejoin the spinal nerve by going through the other communicantes pathway here, and then that's going to take it through the effector organ. All right, so the sympathetic chain we only see really in the thorax and lumbar region, maybe in a couple of divisions of the cervical, but only because it projects up there, not because it receives spinal nerves from that region. So these are what we call sympathetic chain ganglia. Sometimes we call these the paravertebral ganglia because they're on either side. They pair up on either side of the vertebral column, and that's where that first synapse is, right? That we call that the ganglionic synapse. The sympathetic nervous system is characterized by a lot of divergent and convergent pathways. So nerves will bifurcate and then rejoin with other sympathetic nerves, so that when the sympathetic nervous system becomes activated, the whole sympathetic nervous system becomes activated, because these signals are going everywhere. Just think of a big mesh or network or net. We stimulate one part of that net, then there's electrical activity going through the whole sympathetic nervous system. We call that mass activation. So if we look at that on a slide, so here is a preganglionic fiber, right, entering the white ramus communicantes, and if you look at your anatomy book, you see it's actually in the wrong spot. The white is over here, and the gray is over here, and if it's white, what can you tell me about this preganglionic fiber? If this is a white ramus communicantes, and here's a gray ramus. It is myelinated, right? So the preganglionic fiber is myelinated. The postganglionic fiber is not myelinated, right? And that's why we would call this the gray ramus communicantes right here. Right, so the preganglionic fiber enters the sympathetic chain, and then we can see that it bifurcates or trifurcates, and it can pass straight through the sympathetic chain. It can arise through the sympathetic chain or descend. All right, and so that one signal from this one motor neuron is going to a lot of different places because of that divergence. All right, so that's what I want you to see on this slide. But it's also characterized by convergence. So let's look at this nerve here and this one over here. We see that they join together, right, within another ganglion. And so that's what we mean by convergence. And the reason why there are convergent pathways is because if this nerve here, this splanchnic nerve, gets damaged, that's okay, because activity can still go through this other splanchnic nerve over here to reach an effector organ. So it just allows for an alternate pathway to get to a vital effector organ. All right, so here are the sympathetic chain ganglia. Sometimes we call these the paravertebral because they're on either side of the spinal cord. But you notice another one over here. We call this a collateral ganglion. So what does a ganglion have once again? I'm pointing right to it. A cell body, right? And for these outflow pathways, the cell body in the ganglion is always going to be the cell body of the postganglionic fiber. That's all there's to it. Okay. And you know the neurotransmitter that's working between the preganglionic and postganglionic fiber is going to be acetylcholine, and that cholinergic receptor is of the nicotinic type, right? So it is always excitatory. So here's that preganglionic fiber. We see that it can synapse in the sympathetic chain ganglia, and sometimes it passes right through the sympathetic chain to this auxiliary ganglion that we call a collateral ganglia. These collateral ganglia are in front or anterior to the vertebral column, so sometimes these right here we call the prevertebral. Prevertebral in front of the vertebral column, the paravertebral are on either side. Paravertebral, the sympathetic chain, the prevertebral are these collateral ganglia. So this is all preganglionic fiber, and then here is that postganglionic fiber going to the effector organ. Okay, so remember, autonomic outflow pathway always requires two neurons to get to the effector organ. And on this slide right here, what we see are the paravertebral ganglia on either side of the vertebral column here and here, and then here are the collateral or the prevertebral ganglia. Did I say prevertebral ganglia here? I meant to say what? Paravertebral on either side of the vertebral column. In front are the prevertebral ganglia. So what kind of nerve impulses are going through this network of nerves right here? Somatic impulses or parasympathetic or sympathetic? Or all three? It is only sympathetic tone, only sympathetic activity is going through this network of nerves that we see. Okay, and it's either got a synapse in the paravertebral ganglia or the prevertebral ganglia, and at that synapse, you have to use acetylcholine. There's only one example, one good exception to this rule of having two neurons before an effector organ is stimulated, and that is the outflow pathway to the adrenal medulla. And I think you know where the adrenal medulla is. Is it on this slide? Ah, here's the adrenal medulla right here, right on top of the kidneys. And not the cortex, but the medulla is a sympathetic organ. When it becomes stimulated, it releases norepinephrine and epinephrine into the blood. And remember, those are sympathetic ligands, and the blood carries those sympathetic signals all over your body and produces a sympathetic response all over your body, which again kind of supports that convergent and divergent architecture of these nerves, which then you can see fills in and supports the role of mass activation, because that sympathetic tone via epinephrine and norepinephrine goes everywhere in your body. All right, so I think I'm going to have a picture of it in just a second. So let's go flip through right here. So here's the spinal cord, right? And I see some spinal nerves leaving from T1 to L2, and you know what kind of autonomic activity leaves the spinal cord from these levels right here. It would be sympathetic, right? And here's another clue, because these preganglionic fibers enter the sympathetic chain, so for sure now we know this to be a sympathetic tone or sympathetic outflow pathway. Sometimes it's synapses, so here's the postganglionic fiber, right, in this particular case going to the heart. Here is a preganglionic fiber passing straight through the sympathetic chain, and in almost all cases then, it's going to synapse in a prevertebral ganglia. Right, and then here is the postganglionic fiber. So most of the time it's preganglionic, postganglionic fiber. Here's one exception to that rule. So here is sympathetic outflow pathway passing straight through this celiac ganglia. You don't have to know the names of these ganglia. Right? And it just passes straight through. It doesn't synapse. And where does it go? It goes all the way to the adrenal medulla. And this is just going to be a splanchnic nerve. That's what we call a splanchnic nerve. It's carrying sympathetic signals. All right, so you might be wondering, where is the postganglionic fiber? Because we said autonomic outflow always has two neurons. But in this case, I only see one, and you are right. Right? Those cells of the adrenal medulla, they're called chromaffin cells. When they depolarize due to acetylcholine being released on them from this preganglionic fiber, they don't start an action potential and carry that action potential anyplace. Right? They then immediately release norepinephrine and epinephrine into the blood. So those are acting more like an endocrine cell than a nerve cell. Right, because they're not sending action potentials, they're releasing something that gets picked up by the blood and carried everywhere. That is the definition of a hormone. It's a signaling compound that is distributed by the circulatory system, as opposed to being carried by a duct. That would be an exocrine gland. So the adrenal medulla is an endocrine gland. Those cells are acting like the postganglionic fiber. And as a matter of fact, when we think of norepinephrine and epinephrine from the adrenal medulla, we're kind of confused. Is that really a hormone or is it a neurotransmitter? You could think of it as both, because those chromatin cells are really the postganglionic cells in this outflow pathway, then those chemicals would be called a neurotransmitter. But because they're picked up by the blood and carried everywhere, then we would have to call them a hormone. So what would we like to call them? Norepinephrine and epinephrine released from the adrenal medulla? A hormone or a neurotransmitter? And the correct answer is, there's really no correct answer, it's both. So we call them a neurohormone, right? And there's a couple places in our body that we're going to study where there are chemicals that we can't really say for sure if they're a neurotransmitter or a hormone. They have characteristics of each, and we call them neurohormones, which then just sort of demonstrates, or does demonstrate, the nice interface between the nervous system and the other system that controls your body, which we call the endocrine system. And in a lot of classes, we don't study the nervous system by itself. We study it along with the endocrine system, and then that chapter is called the neuroendocrine system, because they do interface in some very important areas. And here is one of them within the adrenal medulla. Right, this is the only example you have to know where there's only one fiber, there's only a preganglionic fiber. The rest always require two. Okay, so let me go back to... We talked about that. All right, so epinephrine and norepinephrine are also, well, we did talk about this. They're derived from tyrosine, right? That's an essential amino acid, and then it's modified into DOPA, modified into dopamine, and then norepinephrine. Finally, norepinephrine is converted into epinephrine, and you can just see some minor changes of tyrosine to make epinephrine. But these even small changes in structure can mean large changes in how these chemicals function in our body. Okay, so let's talk about parasympathetic nervous system. Which one is that, fight or flight or rest and digest? Rest and digest, that's right. Okay, now these parasympathetic nerves don't leave from the thoracic region or lumbar region. They leave through cranial nerves, right? And you probably know one cranial nerve that's really important for this, and also some sacral spinal nerves. So because of that, we call that the cranial sacral division of the autonomic nervous system. Cranial sacral division of the autonomic nervous system is exactly the same as the parasympathetic division. Okay. So those that come from the cranium leave the midbrain, medulla, and pons, and especially cranial nerve number 10. Who could tell me the name of cranial nerve number 10? Yeah, that's the vagus nerve. Okay, vagus nerve. Very important nerve because it goes to most of the organs in our body. And again, it requires two neurons to go from the CNS to the effector organ. Let's take a look. I see a vagus nerve, right? Leaving cranial nerve number 10. It goes all the way down through the neck, through the cervical region, and then it bifurcates and it goes to all of the organs in the thorax and most of the organs in the abdominal cavity, and for sure the superior abdominal cavity, but it doesn't go into the pelvic cavity. The pelvic cavity and lower divisions of the abdominal cavity receive parasympathetic nerves from the sacral divisions, from S2 to S4. All right, so that's kind of the line of demarcation, but the vagus goes pretty much everywhere else. And so people notice that vagus nerve, when they traced it, wandered around almost everywhere in the body. And what do you call a person that just kind of wanders around? A vagabond. Okay, and so that's how they came up with that name, vagus, for that nerve, because it just kind of wanders around everywhere. All right, so let's take a look here at this diagram. So we see probably the nice red color, that sympathetic outflow, what thoracolumbar. The blue represents cranial sacral, but does it still require two neurons? All right, here's cranial nerve number 10, vagus. We can see it going into the thorax, and here's where it stops, right on the surface of the lung. And I can see the postganglionic fiber then carries that signal into the lungs. So there's a ganglion here right on the surface of the lungs. It's not a sympathetic chain. It's not a prevertebral or paravertebral. Sometimes we just call this a terminal ganglion. So terminal ganglia are in the parasympathetic nervous system. Those others that I mentioned are in the sympathetic nervous system. You might also notice that parasympathetic preganglionic fibers are long. Sympathetic preganglionic fibers are short, which means that the postganglionic fiber in the parasympathetic nervous system is short, but the postganglionic fiber in the sympathetic nervous system is now long. All right, so there are some important differences, but both follow the same scheme for myelination. Both pre's are myelinated, both posts are not myelinated. And in the terminal ganglia, the neurotransmitter that's being used is acetylcholine, just like for the sympathetic nervous system. And the receptor type is not muscarinic, it's going to be a nicotinic receptor as well. So there's a lot of similarity between the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system within that ganglia. Use the same neurotransmitter, same receptor types. Okay. Now the postganglionic fiber for a parasympathetic nervous system releases acetylcholine. The neurotransmitter released by the postganglionic fiber in the sympathetic nervous system does not release acetylcholine. We might be able to find an exception to that, but it releases norepinephrine. Right? So norepinephrine is the sympathetic neurotransmitter. Acetylcholine is the parasympathetic neurotransmitter if we ignore all of these ganglia right here. Okay. But now the receptors in these effector organs could either be nicotinic or they could be muscarinic. And as a matter of fact, probably I would like to say, cancel out that nicotinic. They're always going to be a muscarinic receptor. Right? And because they're muscarinic receptors, that parasympathetic stimulation could cause inhibition or excitation because those muscarinic receptors can do either depending on how they're linked together. All right, so let's look at some of these organs right here. Here I see the eye. And is this innervated by the parasympathetic nervous system or the sympathetic nervous system? Ah, both. I like that. That's right. We call that dual innervation. Right? And if there's dual innervation, that means that whatever the structure is under antagonistic control. All right? What about these salivary glands? Right here. Sympathetic or parasympathetic? Yeah, it's dually innervated by both. What about the lungs? Dually innervated by both. Right? But if we look at the heart over here, in particular the ventricles, right, I only see sympathetic nerves go to the ventricles. I do see some parasympathetic nerves going to the atria, but not to the ventricles. So there is not dual innervation of the heart, especially the ventricles. I think that's going to be important. All right, where else do we see a kind of a breakdown of that motif where there's just single innervation? Here is another example. All right, the nerve going to the adrenal medulla is only sympathetic. There are no parasympathetic nerves that go to the adrenal medulla, but there are parasympathetic and sympathetic that go to the kidney, okay? They go to the urinary bladder, go to the reproductive tract. All right, so here are a couple examples where you don't have dual innervation, but usually we do, and most of the time it is antagonistic. Here is a nice table, 9.4, right, that has various organs in the first column, sympathetic effect in the second, and parasympathetic effect in the third column. And if we look at these organs, most of the time we're going to see that sympathetic and parasympathetic are antagonistic to each other. All right, so the iris of the eye does have sympathetic nerves and parasympathetic nerves. And you can see that sympathetic causes dilation during fight and flight response, rest and digest response. There's constriction of the pupils. Right, so that's a nice antagonistic effect. Most of the time we see that. Okay, here's the heart. Both sympathetic and parasympathetic go to the sinoatrial node. You know what the sinoatrial node does? I don't know if we talk about that. Yeah, we just barely talk about that in anatomy. That controls the heart rate, okay? How fast the heart beats. And so the sympathetic increases the heart rate, And the parasympathetic decreases the heart rate. So the atria do have dual innervation. All right, but what did we say about the ventricles? Not dually innervated. It only has sympathetic nerves going to it. So, and sympathetic will increase the force of contraction. And so the strength of contraction of the heart is increased by the sympathetic nervous system, but not the parasympathetic nervous system, because there are no parasympathetic nerves that go to the heart. So there's no antagonistic control of the heart. We might see what that produces maybe a little bit later on. Okay, bronchioles, those are the tubes in your lungs. Dilation for sympathetic, constriction for parasympathetic. When a tube dilates, then flow becomes enhanced through that particular tube. When it constricts, blood flow is decreased, or airflow decreases tremendously. All right, so nice dual innervation, nice antagonism here. Okay, what else do I want to point out? Here, sphincters, gastrointestinal tract. In the digestive tract, sympathetic activity inhibits motion, right? But the parasympathetic stimulates, because parasympathetic we call, what, the rest and digest nervous system. Because when you're threatened with a life-threatening circumstance, then digestion is not really the most important thing. You need all that blood going to muscles. Okay. So you might want to just compare some of these things as we talk about the autonomic nervous system in terms of the fight or flight nervous system and rest and digest nervous system. Most of the time, right, they're antagonistic dual innervation, but there are some cases where there's not dual innervation. I think this is where I wanted to talk about this one. Did I close it down? Okay. I put an additional PowerPoint slide, actually two PowerPoint slides, in the lecture notes just recently. So you haven't downloaded these. So you might want to copy this down, but you can also get a copy of these two slides. All right, so autonomic nervous system actions. We said most are what? Dual innervation. That dual innervation might have actually three different possibilities. Most of the time, it is antagonistic to each other. For instance, sympathetic causes pupil dilation, parasympathetic pupil constriction. Nice antagonistic effect. Sometimes, let's go down to this one. Sometimes the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system is, they cooperate with each other. And what we mean by cooperation is that sympathetic and parasympathetic produce different effects, all right, but those different effects all produce the same kind of function in the body. For instance, sympathetic stimulation causes ejaculation, but parasympathetic stimulation causes erection of the penis. You need to have both of these for what? Proper reproductive behavior. So these two produce different effects, right? Ejaculation versus ejection, but both of these have to work together for procreation. So we call that cooperative. Sometimes it is complementary. Sometimes sympathetic and parasympathetic is complementary. A good example is in the production of saliva. Parasympathetic causes increased salivary secretion, and sympathetic will cause a decrease in blood flow to the salivary glands that changes the nature of saliva so that it becomes thicker. All right, so that dual innervation produces an increased amount of viscous saliva. We call that a complementary. So these are not antagonistic effects. They're either complementary or cooperative. Here you get a couple examples. Most of the time, dual innervation produces what? Antagonism. All right. There are some organs, we said, that are singly innervated, only receive information from one division of the autonomic nervous system. We talked about the adrenal medulla, and I tell you what, in each case, it's going to be sympathetic only. So parasympathetic innervation is left out. Good example, adrenal medulla that we saw. The ventricular myocardium only receives sympathetic tone, and that's going to be excitatory. And if we increase the strength of contraction on the heart, right, We call that a positive inotropic effect. When we affect the inotropy of the heart, we're affecting the force of contraction as opposed to the rate. So the force of contraction and the rate of contraction are two different things. They're controlled a little bit differently. Force of contraction is inotropy. And we're going to see when we get into the cardiac chapter that the rate of contraction is what we call chronotropy, right? Chronograph is just some kind of instrument that can measure time or keep track of time. All right, some blood vessels, actually most blood vessels, only receive sympathetic innervation, and it's excitatory. It causes vasoconstriction. So blood vessels get smaller, the diameter gets smaller. That has a direct effect on blood pressure. Right, and I don't know if you've looked at this in lab yet, we haven't talked about it, but let's just talk about it really briefly at the moment. Say you have a balloon, and it's full of air or full of water, and you press down on the balloon. What happens to the pressure inside that balloon? Does it go up or down? Pressure goes up. And if you squeeze too much, what happens to the pressure? It's high enough that it might burst the balloon, right? So vasoconstriction increases blood pressure. What happens if the heart starts to beat more strongly? Can you imagine what happens to blood pressure? If your heart becomes stronger, would your blood pressure go down or up? It goes up as well. Okay. And these hormones from the adrenal medulla also stimulate the heart into contracting faster and causes vasoconstriction. So these neurohormones from the adrenal medulla also increase blood pressure. So all of these things produce an increase in blood pressure. All right, a couple other organs. Erector pili. You know where these are. These are little muscles attached to hair follicles, smooth muscles, and they're singly innervated only by the sympathetic nervous system to contract, to produce goose pimples when you're cold or you have a certain kind of emotional stimulus. And sweat glands on the surface of your body are singly innervated as well, right? And it is excitatory. So in each case that we see right here, it's going to be excitatory. There's no inhibitory effect of these sympathetic nerves going to these five examples of glands. So those are some interesting exceptions to the rule of dual innervation. Here we are back where we wanted to be. Okay, so we just briefly mentioned some neurotransmitters that are used by the autonomic nervous system, and we saw that most of the time it is acetylcholine, and sometimes it is norepinephrine. But we've got to be really clear on where these neurotransmitters are. All right, so again, I can see both the sympathetic outflow pathways and parasympathetic outflow pathways. So here is, let me get my pointer back working. All right, so sympathetic is what? Thoracolumbar. Here is a preganglionic fiber going to the adrenal medulla that stimulates the adrenal medulla to release epinephrine and norepinephrine in the blood. I don't see a postganglionic fiber, which means that these cells of the adrenal medulla are acting like the postganglionic fiber. They're quasi postganglionic fibers. Hence, norepinephrine and norepinephrine, I don't know if I really want to call them hormones. We should really call these neurohormones, right? And since they have a hormone-like action, they get absorbed by a capillary and delivered everywhere in the body. Another sympathetic outflow pathway goes to a paravertebral ganglia. Maybe another one goes to a collateral ganglia where it synapses. So I see the postganglionic fiber. And in each one of these synapses right here, the neurotransmitter is acetylcholine. So the preganglionic fiber is what we call cholinergic. Preganglionic fiber is cholinergic. The postganglionic fibers release norepinephrine. So these are not cholinergic fibers, these are adrenergic fibers because they release norepinephrine. Even this example up over here, norepinephrine. There are just only a couple examples in the sympathetic nervous system where the postganglionic fiber releases something other than norepinephrine. And even it could even release acetylcholine, right, as kind of a rare exception. Parasympathetic nervous system, again, requires two neurons, pre- and postganglionic fiber. There's got to be a ganglion someplace in between. The neurotransmitter at the ganglion, in this case not the para- or pre-vertebral ganglia, but this is a terminal ganglia right in or on the surface of the organ. The transmitter is going to be acetylcholine. And we see that the neurotransmitter from the postganglionic fiber is acetylcholine. So both the pre- and the postganglionic fiber for parasympathetic outflow are cholinergic. Right? They're both cholinergic, which means they both release acetylcholine. So here is, this is an exam figure. Right? You might have been practicing with this already. Oh, but it's not on the test coming up on Tuesday. Right? It will be on the next test. But probably might want to start working on this one. Right? So cholinergic fiber, cholinergic, cholinergic, cholinergic. All the preganglionic fibers are cholinergic. Postganglionic fibers for parasympathetic here and here are cholinergic, but the postganglionic fibers for sympathetic are what we say adrenergic because it's releasing norepinephrine. So this is a really handy slide. Probably you should be able to draw this one out. That's a good one. Okay. Autonomic neurons don't have neurotransmitter release the same way that a somatic motor neuron does. Somatic motor neuron has a terminal button or a Bouton terminale right at the terminus of an axon. But in the autonomic nervous system, I see a nice motor neuron right here. Here's the axon. And then before we get to the end, I see a swelling. That swelling contains synaptic vesicles filled with neurotransmitter. And then another part of an axon with another swelling that has neurotransmitter and synaptic vesicles. And that repeats itself. Right? And so there are, kind of looks like a string of pearls right here. And so there are synapses all along the length of this axon, this autonomic axon. And of course this is going to be what? A postganglionic fiber. So we call this synapses en passant. So as an active potential passes through all of these little, well, these things are called varicosities, neurotransmitter is released from each of these varicosities, not just the axon terminus. And the same thing for the parasympathetic nervous system. So what do these cells kind of look like to you? They kind of look like a stretched out football right here. So it's going to be an effector organ for the autonomic nervous system. What are the three kinds of effector organs? You got cardiac muscle, smooth muscle, and glands, right? And of those three, what does this look like right here? And it looks like a smooth muscle. Yeah, that's a smooth muscle. And you know, smooth muscle is a lot different than skeletal muscle. Here is a reason why. Skeletal muscle only receives somatic motor neuron. Smooth muscle receives what? Both sympathetic and parasympathetic motor neurons. And these release different kinds of neurotransmitters. So here we have a sympathetic nerve releasing norepinephrine. Here we have a parasympathetic nerve releasing acetylcholine. So we have one adrenergic nerve, one cholinergic nerve releasing their particular neurotransmitters. And the smooth muscle cell has receptors for both. Right? It doesn't have receptors for one or the other. And they will both be stimulated, okay, by acetylcholine and norepinephrine, and it will have antagonistic effects on the smooth muscle cell. All right, so the smooth muscle cell actually then is a lot smarter than a skeletal muscle. When a skeletal muscle is stimulated with neurotransmitter, what does it have to do? It's obligated to contract. It never has a choice, right? When acetylcholine is released at the neuromuscular junction, that skeletal muscle always has to contract because of where those voltage-gated channels are, and also just the size of the neuromuscular junction is huge. But what about this smooth muscle right here? It's smart because it can make up its mind whether it's going to contract or not, depending on, right, the sympathetic activity compared to the parasympathetic activity. So smooth muscle can balance these different effects out and then make up its own mind if it's going to, how it's going to contract. Right. And in either case, whether it's an adrenergic receptor or a cholinergic receptor on a smooth muscle, what does it look like to you? Does it look like, does this look like a nicotinic or a G-protein coupled type receptor? These are going to be G-protein coupled receptors for both the adrenergic receptors and the cholinergic receptors, are G-protein coupled receptors. Okay, so let's focus first on adrenergic stimulation. And where does adrenergic stimulation come from? What division of the autonomic nervous system? Parasympathetic or sympathetic? It is sympathetic, and in particular, the postganglionic fiber, okay, has to have adrenergic receptors. But there's more than one kind of adrenergic receptor. And we're gonna learn three of the subclasses. Some of the subclasses of adrenergic receptors are broken down into alpha and beta types, and then there's even some subclasses of alpha and beta. There's alpha 1, alpha 2, beta 1, and beta 2, and we're going to look at a couple of these. Nonetheless, all of these are G-protein coupled receptors that work through second messengers. The beta receptors work through cyclic AMP as a second messenger. So in order to make cyclic AMP from ATP, what kind of enzyme do you need? Do you know the name of that enzyme? You know, you might have to know that for the test coming up. I didn't talk about it today. I talked about it last time. So yes, you do have to know the name of that enzyme that takes ATP and makes cyclic AMP, or that second messenger, out of it. And that's called adenylate cyclase. Right? That's on an exam figure, important exam figure for you to know. So beta receptors use cyclic AMP as a second messenger, while the alpha type receptors use calcium as second messengers. All right, so where do you find a second messenger? Inside or outside the cell? Always inside the cell. And the first what's going to be the first messenger in this case? Since it's adrenergic stimulation, it's going to be the first messenger that's trapped outside the cell, can't get in, is always going to be norepinephrine, right? Norepinephrine for the sympathetic nervous system. All right, so let's look at some of these. In the eye, okay, in the eye, there are alpha-1 adrenergic receptors. And what happens to the eye? It causes contraction of the radial fibers of the iris. The radial fibers are like spokes on a wheel, and when they contract, it pulls the iris open. It makes the pupil bigger. Right? But nonetheless, what I want you to see, alpha-1 is what? Excitatory or inhibitory on these smooth muscles of the iris? Excitatory, causes contraction, right? So try to remember, alpha-1 are important because they're excitatory. All right, let's see, alpha-1, the kind of receptor that I'm not going to talk about in class are the alpha-2 receptors. There are alpha-2 receptors. They're mostly located in the brain, and they have a lot of different kinds of functions. And we don't talk about them much in this class, except under certain kinds of condition that are important for regulating blood pressure. But when we get to the heart, I'll talk about those, not in this one. But we do have to know something about the beta receptors, both the beta 1 and beta 2. All right, so right after the eye, we have the heart. And the heart has primarily beta 1 receptors. Norepinephrine binds to these beta 1 receptors. It causes increased heart rate and strength of contraction. Both chronotropy and inotropy of the heart is increased, heart rate and force of contraction, because it has a beta 1 receptor. So would you call that increased excitatory or inhibitory on the heart? It's excitatory. So beta 1 receptors are excitatory, like the alpha 1. The last kind of, well, let's look at some blood vessels. They both have alpha 1, cause constriction. So again, alpha-1 is what, excitatory or inhibitory? Excitatory once again. All right, so then let's get to the beta-2. The beta-2 cause dilation of arterioles, right? And so we see that in some skeletal muscles, but we also see beta-2s in the bronchioles, and it causes dilation of smooth muscle of these really small tubes in our lungs. And when those muscles when those tubes dilate, it means that those muscles have to relax, right? When the muscles relax, the bronchioles dilate, and it's easier to breathe, much easier to breathe. So would we call that relaxation of smooth muscle excitatory or inhibitory? That would be an inhibition of those smooth muscles. It causes them to relax, not to contract more. All right, so how on earth are you going to remember something about these beta receptors? And actually, it's pretty easy, because what do you have in your heart? What do you have? What kind of receptor do you have in your heart? So you got to watch me, otherwise you can't just listen to the tape. Okay. What kind of receptors do you have in your heart? It says they're on the slide. They're beta what? Beta 1, Okay, what are the kinds of receptors that you have in your lungs? Beta 2. How many lungs do you have? How many hearts do you have? One. So it's pretty easy to remember, right? The thing then you have to remember, beta 1 are excitatory, but beta 2 are inhibitory. So there's different kinds of ligand-gated channels, right, that are going to be operating, because some are going to cause depolarization, some are going to cause hyperpolarization. Like the beta 2 cause hyperpolarization, beta 1 cause depolarization. Okay, so I think that's good enough for that slide for now. All right, so I see some outflow pathways, right? And I see two neurons back to back. So what kind of outflow pathways are these? Are these somatic or autonomic? Somatic or autonomic? And it's, hopefully you can understand the question. Right, the nice distinction there, there's a, between somatic and autonomic. Somatic, the effector organ is just skeletal muscle, but I see two neurons, which means it has to be an autonomic outflow pathway, not a somatic motor pathway. Right. Here are the ganglia, right, between the preganglionic and postganglionic fiber. And what did we say the neurotransmitter that's released from the parasympathetic preganglionic fiber was? Acetylcholine, right? And but here is sympathetic nervous system, and it's going to release a neurotransmitter at a ganglia, and guess what that neurotransmitter is? It's going to be acetylcholine, just like in the parasympathetic nervous system, and the receptors on the postganglionic fibers are going to be of the nicotinic type, so acetylcholine is always going to be excitatory on all of these postganglionic fibers, no matter what division of the autonomic nervous system it is in. All right, well, if everything's the same, why do we make a distinction? And that's because the postganglionic fibers are different, right? The neurotransmitter for the parasympathetic nervous system for a postganglionic fiber is acetylcholine at the effector organ, and it's going to bind to a muscarinic-type acetylcholine receptor, and that could have, what, excitatory or inhibitory effects. All depends on how that G-protein couple receptor is coupled to other proteins within the membrane. All right. And I have three classes of adrenergic receptors over here. The postganglionic fiber for sympathetic outflow is always going to be norepinephrine. And we got to know something about the different kinds of receptors. We said beta 1. Where do we find beta 1? In your heart. And it is what? Inhibitory or excitatory? Excitatory. So that's what this says right here. Stimulates beta 1 adrenergic receptors. Right, we find those in the heart. That increases force of contraction. Beta 1 increased force of contraction. Right, here is another sympathetic outflow pathway. It stimulates beta 2 adrenergic receptors. Where do you have a nice example in your mind of a beta 2? Your lungs. And can you remember if it's excitatory or inhibitory? It's inhibitory because a beta 2 inhibits. That causes dilation of bronchioles. Right. And in blood vessels, there are alpha 1. What can you remember about alpha 1? Are they primarily inhibitory or excitatory? They're excitatory. They're more like the beta 1 type receptors. We find these in blood vessels that cause vasoconstriction. Okay, so this is a nice, really handy illustration to help you remember alpha 1, beta 1, beta 2, and muscarinic type receptors for autonomic outflow. There are subclasses of muscarinic receptors that we're not going to talk about, but you got to be familiar with what? The two main kinds of cholinergic receptors, nicotinic and muscarinic. Remember, nicotinic is always excitatory. Muscarinic could be one or the other. Okay. And I think after the test then, or maybe I'll put a finish up this lecture online, because it's about time that we close up shop right here. Make sure you sign the sign-in sheet. What I see on this slide are just some cholinergic receptors of the nicotinic type over here that you looked at. And here are two examples of muscarinic receptors, because we said sometimes they can be inhibitory or sometimes they can be excitatory, depending on how this G-protein coupled receptor interacts with other channels within the membrane. Okay, so remind me to start here in case I forget. Yeah, we're almost done with the autonomic nervous system. Just got a couple slides to look at. Oh yeah, how about an announcement from SI? I forgot.
Extra session tomorrow for chapter exam review, and on Tuesday as well with more talks.
Anybody going to go to SI tomorrow? Yeah. Okay.